Hello and welcome to this yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 7th of July 2013. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers and Johnny Fox. I would like to apologise for the sound quality in some of this podcast. Unfortunately, my contributors were in far-flung places, as you'll hear, and the sound did tend to go wrong towards the end. We're now going to talk about Private Lives by Noel Coward. This is his 1930 comedy. He wrote it in a space of 4 days after thinking about it for 2 weeks while he was suffering from influenza, and sent it off to Gertrude Lawrence, and they put it on autumn that year. It's about a couple who get divorced, Amanda and Elliot. They remarry and end up staying in the same hotel in Deauville, and in fact in adjoining rooms, and they meet each other out on the balcony, realise they've fallen in love, and whisk themselves off to Paris. We get an idea of what their life was like in the second act, and then why they got divorced towards the end of that. This production stars Toby Stevens and Amanda Chancellor as Elliot and Amanda, and Anthony Carf and Anna Louise Plowman as their unfortunate new spouses, Victor and Sybil. There was something new in this production for me, and that is that you get a very distinct impression from the start that Amanda and Elliot still aren't happy. They're 5 years after they've divorced, and they're not really happy in their new marriages. It's almost as if they've been talked into it by various mothers, or sort of slightly over. Amanda seems to be bored already with her husband, and you do get the impression that they're not perfectly happy in other productions, but you never quite got the idea that no, they're really quite miserable, and which I felt in this production. This production also plays it a great deal for laughs. I think people were laughing almost from the start, which is always a good thing, because sometimes if the director doesn't get the jokes, then you can get something which is very stilted and rather dark and boring. But this is full of fun, and it does seem that the two leads, Toby Stevens and Anna Chancellor, they have a good chemistry, and they're really very playful together. There's a lot of rather inventive touches, particularly Amanda doing the Rite of Spring. And that's the piece of music that infuriates Elliot. And she actually dances the Rite of Spring, which is rather an interesting try. I believe she has said that, Anna Chancellor has said that she used some of the Nijinsky's choreography on it. So it's a sort of vaguely authentic, and it's very, very strange to see in the second act. But yeah, I'm not absolutely certain. This might be the best production of this play I've seen, although I'm not entirely sure that it should be played quite so for laughs as it was. What did you think about it, John?
I have a lot of Private Lives to compare this with, and including the one in which Toby Stevens' parents knocked each other about at the end of the second act with a great deal of conviction, since Robert Stevens played this at the height of the acrimony leading up to their divorce in 1972, and those fights in the second act were very, very real. In fact, I believe Robert Stevens was blessed during the run by John Standing, and I think it might have been for his own personal safety. I did think it was a very, very good production, and I liked the pace of it, and the fact that even if you'd never seen Private Lives or never knew that it was a sort of landmark in theatrical and literary history, that it was the first comedy where anything was sexualized on stage, you would still have got a great deal out of it. What disturbs me about Private Lives is the reverence with which so many directors continue to treat it in revival after revival, and how it's never taken out of its time or its place. And here you have a 90-year-old comedy about lifestyles that simply aren't relevant anymore. You know, people do not live lives on the Riviera of endless cocktails and laughter. And hang on, where am I at the moment? Oh yes, I'm on a balcony in Spain.
I was just about to point that out.
All right, well, maybe I am less typical than most of modern society, but I wonder how easy it is for contemporary audiences to connect with the story of Amanda and Elliot, rich, spoiled, sarcastic, aggressive people who you're meant to root for. And perhaps turning that around, it's a tribute to the structure of the play that it really does work, that these are the nastiest people you could hope to encounter socially. But when you see their private lives presented on two adjacent balconies, it's them you're rooting for, and it's the people, the poor unfortunates that they have remarried, the nice and decent people like Victor and Sybil, you just would just get out of the way so that Elliot and Amanda can get back together again. I think Toby Stevens is fantastic. It's so much better a version of this than either Matthew McFadyen or that man from Harry Potter in the recent revivals. And for me, I thought it was astonishing how much he looks like his father, but acts like his mother in the same play. Because so many of his double takes and mannerisms and silent gasping with horror and play acting are just what Maggie Smith did herself when she was playing Amanda 40 years ago. But he couldn't have known that. You know, it wasn't filmed, I don't think, and he'd only been three at the time. So maybe, you know, some acting is hereditary. I think it's some of his best works. I think it's some of the best, one of the best things he has done. And he and, well, moving on to Anne Chancellor, this role could have been written around her. She has just the combination of angularity and sardonic sense of humour and underlying intelligence. And the thing she does more convincingly than almost anybody else I've seen play Amanda is that she takes the epigrams and the aphorisms and she delivers them in a way that actually makes you believe they could be part of her everyday conversation. Most of the people hold coward lines like sugar tongs and just deposit them into the audience's cup one by one by one. But she actually made it flow much better for me. Well, I'd like to hear what Phil has to say about the production generally before we bring more elements of it.
Yeah, Phil, what did you think?
I wasn't 100% sure I really wanted to go. Because it had such great reviews at Chichester where it would come from, I thought, well, I'm going to give it another one. I got a £10 day seat, which was, they're not selling the front row because apparently the very restricted view. So I was in about row N of the stalls, which actually gave you a great view. It didn't feel too far back, and it was a great view of the really absolutely fantastic set. This is, I think, my third private life in 4 years, and I think my fourth ever. So, and the last two I saw, I really liked. So I thought, well, it's got a lot to live up to, and it did, because it's incredibly fast. I think I would like to see it played without an interval, because it would be an hour and 35 minutes straight through, and the big set sheets change happens before your eyes anyway. So there's no reason why they can't, apart from probably making money. But I thought Toby Stevens was just brilliant. He reminded me of Hugh Grant quite a lot. And I thought if Hugh Grant ever did stage, it's a shame he never took this pass on. But that's not to say that Toby Stevens isn't fantastic. He had that slightly kind of fixed, awkward, uneasy smile sometimes of Hugh Grant. And I thought he was just very, very funny. Both of them were very funny, I thought. And the Chancellor, it was almost, it could have been written for her. I think particularly the, without giving the ending away, if you don't know, the breakfast, the rather uncomfortable breakfast in the Paris apartment towards the end was just hilariously played. You just couldn't take your eyes off them. And then the silent sort of last 3 or 4 minutes was very, very funny. And I do agree with you, John, and the bit that I heard about the fact that they're really a dreadful pair of shits, aren't they? But the nice Sybil and Victor, the solid Victor, that they sort of crap on them and find happiness in the end. But I think what would be interesting if there was somebody very clever out there could do a What Happened to Amanda and Elliot sort of maybe 10 or 30 years later, would they be hitting people around with their Zimmer frames or something in an old folks home? Well, it wouldn't be an old folks home because they've got so much money, but I'd love to see somebody do a follow-up to this if they could do it with as much wit as Coward has. It's got all the lines, you know, it's Hamlet really. It's got the very flat Norfolk in it, which even though you've heard it a million times, here it made me laugh again just because of the and the Chancellor's delivery of it. I really enjoyed it. I thought it zipped along.
Yes, I'd like to say a word for Anne-Louise Plowman. The two secondary parts of Sybil and Victor are really thankless in many productions. Coward had the sense to cast Laurence Olivier and his then wife, Adrienne Allen, in these roles, knowing that such shadowy, miserable people needed really superb acting to carry them off. And I think, although it's quite a nicety that Anne-Louise Plowman, who is Mrs. Toby Stevens in real life, should also be turning up every night at the same theatre with her husband, she delivers a tremendous performance as Sybil. I think one of the best Sybils I have ever seen. She has quietness and dignity through most of it. And of course, Sybil gets the fewest good lines, but she absolutely makes the most of them. And the worm turning moment at the end when Sybil actually does manage to castigate Amanda and Elliot for their dreadful personalities, it's really worth waiting for and sitting through the slightly soggy middle of the play. I have to say that although this is very fast-paced, perhaps because Jonathan Kent has taken it at such a fast pace, you do feel the lull in the middle of the second act when it isn't quite so sparky as the beginning and the end. But thoroughly good production, really, really enjoyed. I haven't said anything about Anthony Carf playing Victor. Very, very nice delivery. Lovely man, obviously. You have to have characters that you think Amanda and Elliot could fall in love with. And I would say I could see why it went for Sybil, but I couldn't quite see why Amanda was attracted to the very, very stolid and dull and sort of country squire character that Anthony Carf was made to portray. Perhaps she needed his money. It's something that isn't discussed in the play at all. You've no idea how wealthy Amanda and Elliot are or where the source of their income comes from. Elliot doesn't appear to have a job. Amanda doesn't speak of any family connections from which she might have derived her social status. So it's, you were saying, Tim, at the beginning that you know, maybe what were their motives for marrying each of these people? I wonder if in cases it's because they had money. Not sure. Anthony Carf certainly looked as if he was a man of substance. Sybil, you couldn't really tell about. Anyway, very, very good production, worth looking at. I think it's only here till September, so you know, it's not going to outstay its welcome in the West End with so much else pressing to come into good theatres.
Does anybody know if it's been cut at all? Because it seemed much, much shorter than previous production. Is that just the speed that they're playing at?
It has been cut quite a bit. Quite a lot of the lines have been clipped or cut completely. And someday I'll find you. The duet's gone, hasn't it? It's just demoted to a sort of underscore. In most of the other productions, Amanda and Elliot sing it to each other at the piano in the second act.
We're now going to talk about The Drowned Man, a Hollywood fable, which is Punch Drunk's latest production, done in association with the National Theatre. It's inspired by Buchner's work, Wojciech. And it's set in a large building next door to Paddington Station, which is been transformed into the forgotten world of Temple Studios. I haven't actually seen this yet because I have a little bit of trouble with Punch Drunk, having gone to Mask of the Red Death and wandered around for an hour and a half without seeing anything. I think I've said this several times on the podcast. It puts me against this. This company. Their way of doing these promenade productions does mean it is possible to see everything. It is also possible to see nothing at all. And I was in the unfortunate position in The Mask of the Red Death of not seeing anything at all. And I walked out before, which I very rarely do, but I walked out after an hour and a half with them saying, well, why didn't you wait for the finale? Which apparently was spectacular and won a lot of people over in The Mask of the Red Death. And I thought, well, that will just be another thing I'm going to miss. I didn't know at the time that they would actually get everybody together to watch the finale of it. Oh, yes, I have a bit of a problem with Punch Drunk. Phil, what did you think about The Drowned Man, though?
Well, this was my fourth Punch Drunk, and it was sort of, in a way, their last chance for me. The first one I saw was The Faust, which was somewhere in Wapping, I think, where I was incredibly impressed, not just by the logistics of it, but the whole atmosphere that was created. And in a way, this is perhaps closest to The Faust. I'd heard reports from people at early previews that they'd wandered around and hardly seen anything. The absolute opposite happened for us. I would say we spent about 80% of the 3 hours we were there watching performance, and probably most of the other 20% in the bar, because you do need to sort of take a break because it's quite exhausting sort of following it around. I think if you've been to previous Punch Drunk productions, you kind of know how to find the action. Maybe follows an actor if they're wandering somewhere and sort of chase after them because they can move quite quickly. And also follow noise and lighting cues and things like that. I'm still impressed by the logistics of it. I think this one is much busier. There's lots and lots of rooms. They may not have anything performance happening in them, but they're incredibly well dressed. For me, though, it just felt more of the same, wandering and watching some sort of DV8-type performance, which is quite well done, incredibly well-dressed rooms, great period stuff, because it's set in, the film that they're making is set in Middle America, even though the trailers, which the stars are in, it looked very English to me, which I suppose they can't probably afford to ship over an American caravan, so it reminded me of Carry On Camping at times. The finale is very easy to find. You do get sort of funneled through to the finale, and it wasn't actually a very impressive finale by their standards. Even the Duchess of Malfi, which I really couldn't stand at all, had a much more impressive finale. So I wouldn't say you really need to, if you've had enough, you don't really need to stick around for the end. You're not really missing anything. You're not really going to pick up much of the story. I don't know the book that it's based on, or the film that they're making is based on, but you never really pick up the story. I did look up the thing afterwards, and I could pick up little bits of it here and there. I mean, you also knew very clearly when you were seeing the actors being the filmmakers. For instance, I saw auditions. I saw a woman auditioning in front of the director. I saw the sound effects woman with this incredibly pretentious scene where she was bending a handbag under a microphone, and then a mime artist wandered in and she dunked his head in a fish tank, which is exactly what I would do to a mime artist. So that sort of made me laugh. But yeah, there is an incredible amount of pretension going on at these things. But if you've never seen one before, I think it's worth seeing, because it's logistically, it's quite an amazing thing. But I just think it's, for me, it's just more of the same.
John, what do you think?
Well, I come to it from the complete opposite angle. I have never been to a Punch Drunk show before, and I'll never go to one again. I thought it should have been called Waste of Space, because they had this wonderful, wonderful building. They had the resources of the National Theatre. They clearly emptied its entire store of props to dress all these empty rooms in which nothing happens. We started in the basement. I think there must be 8 or 10,000 square foot per floor. It really is an enormous building. And you just start wandering around, and it's room after room of underlit, gloomy space, with or without apparatus in it, without people, and with kind of strange sounds coming over the speakers. And of course, I don't speak from personal experience, but it felt to me like a sex club before opening. It was just like, you know, it was like the Hoist or somewhere like that, just before they let the customers in. It was appalling. And as we mounted, you know, the stairs, and of course, you're supposed to be able to ask the assistants. They're not there to guide you, they're there to help you. And so I wandered over to one of them and said, you know, are all the floors like this, or are there different things on different floors? And he sort of pointed upwards and said, try upstairs. Have I helped you? And I thought, well, the only thing I've learned from you is you smoke roll-ups and you're not very fond of toothpaste. It just really, everything about it was annoying, from the admonition that you had to wear your Venetian plastic mask, which, if you wear glasses, is all but impossible to keep on. And if, like me, you wear glasses for distance but not for close-up, then you're forever fiddling with them behind your mask in order to try and see anything at all. The host is very ferocious with you if you try and take your mask off. It's very, very cold in the basement, and infuriatingly hot everywhere else in the building, especially in the bar, which is where people cluster. There's also a lot of instruction about not speaking and not turning your phone on. But I have to say, most of the customers got to the point at which they were so bored or frustrated or unable to see that they were turning their phones on, either to use as light to guide their way through the very, very dark caverns of the building, or to text and tweet their friends saying, basically, what a load of old shit. Because that is exactly what it is. And I'm not dismissive of site-specific theatre. I love things like Theatre Delicatessen, where you might go to a ramshackle building and you wander from place to place. But you open a door and suddenly there's a room full of people with whom you can engage, and you watch what they're doing, or you join in what they're doing, or they somehow draw you into what they're doing. I felt this ought to have been like Yumi Bum Bum Train. You should just have got inside and been propelled through an endless series of exciting scenes and not exciting scenes, you know, so there would have been light and dark and shade and excitement. But really, in the hour and 50 minutes we spent in the building, we saw one pretty decent male singer sing a jazz song. We saw a kind of magic act whereby a woman hid in a cardboard box and had sticks poked through the sides at her because she was a contortionist and could keep out of the way of them. And we saw a little bit of one scene where a semi-naked couple fighting and making love, and then he fell down a well. But in terms of finding a narrative or discovering what this was about or being able to make any kind of comparison with Wojtek, helpless, absolutely helpless. And I think if it's still in preview, then there will need to be a revision of the guiding and hosting of it so that more people get to see more stuff. Because in the corridors and on the stairs, we kept meeting people going, what the f*** is this? What is going on? I don't understand anything. So I've never yet been to a theatre and asked for my money back on the grounds of poor quality. But I will now be writing to the National, and I encourage everybody else to do the same. If you haven't bought your tickets yet, the National operates a scheme whereby 48 hours before a performance, you can get a credit for the entire cost of a ticket, less £2 handling fee. So do it. And if you haven't bought a ticket for this show yet, don't. Particularly don't buy a ticket at £47.50 like I did. Or the premium seats at £87.50. God knows what people spend that kind of money will think about. It's crap. Stay away.
But it is a problem with this, the way they do things at Punch Drunk, that they don't. That it's possible not to see stuff, and it's possible not to see anything. And
yeah.
So I do wonder if they're going to have to, if people do, like John said, ask them for your money back, that would kind of wake them up to the need to be pushed through. Although I have to say, some shows I've seen, some site-specific shows I've seen, that feeling of being constantly marshalled is a bit annoying. It can be a bit annoying, and you sometimes think, well, yeah, why not just do it in one room? Why not, you know, because you're not really bringing anything to it by letting us wander. But of course, if you wander, you don't always see everything.
I mean, I did see an awful lot, and it's funny, the things that John mentioned, I didn't see any of those. I'd love to have seen somebody in a box having sticks poked through them, but given that we did see an awful lot of performance and an awful lot of, I saw quite a bit of nudity as well, which would always attract a crowd. As I said in the review, the wait for Willy isn't as long as at Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I had the same problem as John, actually, with the... I wore my contact lenses because of the glasses problem, but it meant then I couldn't read anything when you were going into the rooms and they had stationery, and I couldn't see it because then I would have to put my glasses on over my contact lens. So that's frustrating, and it's very sweaty as well.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.